As I understand it, we're talking about art and research and art and the idea of knowledge today. And the way how I want to approach this question is by reformulating it slightly, by putting it in the following terms. What is transferred when art communicates? What are we transferring? What are we conveying? What are we imbuing on each other in a moment when we attend a conference like that? And my intuition is that what's happening when knowledge is shared is a social process. There's a social dynamic and a dynamic of different kind of desires at play in the moment when knowledge is transferred. And this is exactly the kind of dynamic that I'm interested in and which I want to explore a little bit today. And my understanding is that whenever there is a conference, there's always a transference. So as we confer, something is also transferred. And I want to have a closer look at how things are being transferred, and I want to speculate a little bit about what is being transferred. And I believe that is what might be transferred is not just information and not just content, but that there is something inherent to the form in which we confer and transfer in the moment of communicating knowledge that might be much more essential and which I want to explore today. The desires that are at play and the social dynamics, the social mechanisms at play in the moment when what we call knowledge is generated, communicated, and transferred. And the first part of the talk will be looking very closely at those mechanisms of transference, and it's very much about hands. The first part is all about these little slides of the hand when one thing is transferred to another person, when things slip and slide from one pocket into the next, as you see here in this wonderful painting by Georges Latour. And on this side, you see a seance being held in the White House. So you see that there's always something happening. Powers, certain powers are at play, and the hands are moving when hidden knowledge is being generated and channeled. So the first part will be about all these little slides of the hand that happen when transference is at play. In the second part of the talk, I want to speculate a little bit about the underlying dynamics, the invisible dynamics of what I would like to call sentience, because I want to avoid the term unconscious. So I'm trying to say that there are certain desires and emotional charges that underlie the communication and transference of knowledge. And I will look a bit closer at that. And then in the third part of the presentation, I want to propose a few strategies of how we could maybe approach what underlies these gestures of transference. If there's a possibility, maybe, to go beyond all these little handshakes that we see being performed when knowledge is transferred, and maybe discover another form, another artistic strategy of tapping into that pool of sentience, that strange pool of desires and forces that underlies transference in a manner that might actually break with the forms of symbolic discourse. So these are the three parts of the presentation. First, lots of handshakes. Then strangely demonic forces underlying these handshakes. And then finally, some speculations about how to tap into that zone of sentience. Right? What we see here, of course, is a situation of complete entanglement. No? When things are being transferred and conferred, we never know who's proving what to whom and who's fooling whom. No? Is the person on the left being fooled, or is his or her poker face the supreme liar's disguise? We never know. As we're in the zone of transference and conference, there is no outside. Everything on the table is in the game, and there's just ever so many different kind of sleights of the hand and things being passed from one player to the other. That is a game of lies, but it's also a game of politics, you know, as you see here in this beautiful painting by Paris Bordone, where almost identical players are playing against each other, and the sleight of the hand that was a moment of deceit in one game here becomes a form of strategy, a form of politics. And we, of course, understand how these lies and deceits that become politics, how they form entire societies, secret societies that perform their rituals, open to everyone. It is a practice of ongoing initiation, a handshake that seals a bond and that creates that bond and constantly performs what holds that community together. So when people confer and they transfer, they make these handshakes that on a performative level create the societies in which then information and content can be circulated. So my understanding is that at the heart of every discourse there is a kind of a performative dimension of operative knowledge. So on a very basic level, we're talking about some savoir-faire. You have to know how to shake that hand, otherwise you cannot participate in a discourse in which then at some point also content will be generated and mediated. But first of all, it's a matter of getting the handshake right. No? And of course then this handshake generates information, and information can be added. That is Corbusier's model man, but first of all he's invoking his addressee here, the future man. And then of course once the handshake has been performed, the measures can be taken, or the measurements can be taken and conveyed. And there are ever so many handshakes in the history of modern art and modern politics. Some of them deceits, some of them utopian. So we see these recurring handshakes, and that's why I'm suggesting that we should take a closer look at what's happening when the hands are being shaken, and social structures are being created that are structures of power, structures of desire, and then also structures of discourse. So let's have a closer look at the politics of desire that are at play when, as the hands are being shaken, certain things pass over. One thing leads to another, and people are put into places. Now, as the cup travels from one hand into the other, people assume positions in the symbolic order of desire. They become lovers and they become loved. They try to have the cake and eat it, but have it both, no? Which, as Lacan says, is how you inhabit the symbolic order, constantly trying to have the cake and eat it, as you're trying to be a performer in these symbolic structures and at the same time capitalize on them by being the one who's loved and the one who's doing the loving. On a certain level, that is also a question of education. No, what do you teach when you teach the knowledge of strategical handshakes? Assuming that it's all a game that is about power, sex, and money, how do you teach this? Do you even want to teach this? How to inhabit this order of desire in which, in the end, in these handshakes, only empty boxes and little furry things, as you see here in this excerpt from the film Felix Kohl, are being exchanged. Do you teach people to learn and embody what that structure of exchanges demands? Felix Kohl in the novel by Thomas Mann says, you know, he's not a liar because all that he's doing is that he's realizing other people's desires for them by being whatever they want him to be, which is an art form, a technique of desire that, of course, is also a career principle in the arts, you know, to determine the other's desire, find out what the other wants, and deliver precisely that. What kind of opposition could we mobilize against strategies that simply and only inhabit this structure of symbolic exchanges as in a manner that would just seem fit, that would just fulfill the demand? How can we be more than swindlers? When we engage in these games of handshakes, when on the one hand we might not be able to escape those games, as we enter culture and we are involved involuntarily, inevitably in these handshakes. But what kind of resistance could we muster against simply and only being a swindler, simply and only dealing in these empty boxes that give the other what you don't have and what the other doesn't need either? What can we mobilize against this form of learning the rules, this form of education? Because it's a cruel logic. Now, there's a devastatingly clear and cruel scene in the first movie adaptation of the novel The Talented Mr. Ripley, Plan Soleil, where shortly before the guy who Ripley will kill to take his place, shortly before he gets killed, he realizes what's going to happen, and he asks Ripley on the boat, so after you killed me, what will you do? And Ripley answers, well, I'm going to fake your signature, and then I'm going to get your money. And then Greenblatt asks, like, yeah, but how did you learn to fake my signature? And then Ripley says this terrifying sentence, tout s'apprend, everything learns itself. No? And it's even not, there is no subject involved, there is no subjectivity being produced, it is not I have learned, but tout s'apprend, everything learns itself. No? And in that sense, Ripley as Kroll are perfect embodiments of what it means to embody and inhabit the structure of symbolic exchanges as it is. No subject is being generated. There is just a form of technical knowledge that's being acquired as you inhabit that order and occupy positions that are vacated through moments of sacrifice, through killing someone, and then you take that place. Well, because it has learned itself, no? And that is the sheer embodiment of the technicality of these gestures. It's murder. The order of tout s'apprend. So there must be something more to learning and knowledge than just the cruel logic of tout s'apprend. But what could that be? But first of all, I want to stay a little bit more with the order of tout s'apprend. I want to look a little bit more closely how things learn themselves and how things slip into positions and how these little societies are formed of people who learn how to perform the trick, that little sleight of the hand. And I'm going to show you this most beautiful, well, it's actually a short compilation of my favorite scenes from Robert Bresson's Pickpockets. And it's a very in-depth study of what happens when men perform these little tricks together. So,
je n'ai voir.
What we have here is a scene of learning, right? It's a scene where a knowledge is acquired through practical initiation. So, and it shows comment les choses s'apprend, like it shows how things learn themselves. And I want to say that there's three dimensions of this ritual of how things learn themselves that I want to draw your attention to. One is that it creates an economy of gestures, and it is in the nature of this economy. In the nature of this economy is that when it's running, other people can join it. You know, there's this beautiful moment when the third guy joins the table and it needs no further introduction. No, compris, it's understood that the third guy is already part of this network of male bonding because its economy of gestures has already been established. Once the economy of transference is running, anybody can join it. And it needs no further introduction. He doesn't have to be introduced as a subject. The fact that he can perform the gestures means that he's already a part of this economy, which, as you can see, is an economy of male bonding, which is based on the fact that men get together to get a job done. And as you, well, obviously there is a strong tension of desire at play, which has certain connotations. And this is a painting by the divine Lukas Duvenhöger, which in a way interprets the pickpockets in a manner and explicates some of the libidinous energies that are always at play, I think, when men get together to get it done. So there's a lot of slipping and sliding going on here. So when men support each other carefully in the act of becoming part of the story, becoming part of this economy in which power, money and sex circulate, there's always certain stories and certain tensions underlying that economy, I would argue. So when we know that scene, we've seen it before. No, this game has been played for a long time. Another interesting aspect is, the second aspect that I want to draw your attention to, is that even though this economy functions so seamlessly, and the object travels from one pocket to the next and players join it in all moments, it produces a particular surplus. At some point, something gets lost. Now, that's the moment when the cash drops and when the purse drops. That's the moment when some kind of strange surplus is produced, and the economy produces a leftover, a relic, a remainder, a little piece of shit that drops from the economy and falls out. You know? It's something irreversible happens, that purse is gone. And it's interesting, you know? On the one hand, everything seems reversible, every slippage and slide can be repeated in ever so many ways, but then there's this one moment of irreversibility that I want to come back to in the end, where something is dropped, something falls out from the system. And the last aspect that I want to draw your attention to is that in this economy, some people are agents and some people are carriers. There is this scene in this beautiful train theft scenario where this particularly innocent guy with the blonde hair, he becomes a carrier. So because it's essential for pickpockets that they should never be caught in the possession of what they've just stolen, so they have to constantly pass the thing on. No, in a functioning economy, there has to be constant transference. The thing has to be in motion. And you can keep it in motion by acting, but you can also keep it in motion by choosing a carrier. And in this case, it's this innocent blonde guy who, for a brief moment, gets to carry the purse that has just been stolen. So he carries it on the train, and then they take it again from him. No? So in such an economy of gestures, it's not just the people who act, but it's also the witnesses, the involuntary witnesses that become carriers in the system of transference that play a certain role. No, he doesn't even know that he became part of the economy, but suddenly he is. No, he carried the thing from one place to another. Psychoanalytically speaking, becoming the carrier in a moment of transference is a curse. No, when suddenly you get drawn into a scenario where something strange is passed on from one person to another, from one generation to the next, suddenly you end up in an economy where what is passed on is not just a thing, but a thing that has a curse, and suddenly you have it. No, maybe your father and your mother had it first, and suddenly you have it. And what do you do with it? Do you, being the carrier, it's not yours, it was not theirs, it came from a generation before. You are the carrier now, you carry it. What do you do with it? No? And a film, it's a Hollywood movie, but that always comes to my mind when I think about the carrier being a carrier of a curse that has been passed on for generations to generations. It's one of my favorite Hollywood movies. It's Fallen with Denzel Washington. And the story of that movie is that there's a demon that walks the earth for generations and generations, and he inhabits people's bodies, and the way how he gets to inhabit those bodies is through touch. So again, we see the handshake, the shake of the hand, but what is transferred here is not money and power, but the curse, a curse that has existed on the planet for a long time. And I'm going to show you the scene where you see the moment of transference when the demon wanders. And one thing you need to know is that in the beginning of the film, a mass murderer gets executed, and shortly before he dies, he sings the song, "Time is on my side." And then his spirit wanders to a prison guard, and then the spirit keeps wandering. And in the beginning of the scene, the demon identifies himself by doing a little bit of Rolling Stones. But Here you go. This is the demon. Watch the hands.
Come here. Come on, come here. Time is on my side. Yes, it is. Time is on my side. Yes, it is.
Lou.
What? You're always saying that you wanna be free, but I'm never running back.
Mike.
I think that scene will be familiar to you. No. For anyone who works in a bigger institution, those days when everybody seems to be singing the same song, and you just don't know how did they learn it? Why is everybody singing the same song? No, where did that knowledge come from? Then one person speaks, the other continues, and what we have here at the heart of transference is, of course, also the essence of tradition. Now that's how tradition works, where something gets handed down from generation to generation. No one actually knows where it's coming from. No, the parents didn't know, they got it from their parents, they pass it on to the next generation. And each new generation becomes a carrier and they continue that song. No, and there is of course a modernist impulse, the impulse of the modernist artist to say, let's burn the museum. Let's stop the tradition. No more new bodies to continue this tradition of transference. We have to cut it. The possibility of that ever to happen, that this tradition becomes interrupted, at least is judged skeptical by the makers of this movie. No, in the end of the movie, shall I tell the end? Yeah, okay. So at the end of the movie, the detective sacrifices his body, allows the demon to enter his body, and then shoots himself to end the transference. Unfortunately, a fox walks by, the demon jumps to the fox, and the story continues. But here we identify the underlying logic of sentience, that kind of strangely, that strange dynamic of desire that does not just connect people in hierarchies and performative structures, but it is something that connects generations, because it is a particular kind of memory, a particular kind of potentially traumatic memory that is handed down from generation to generation, and underlies the transfer of knowledge. It is the reason why they all suddenly know how to sing that song. And the question is then, how do we tap into that underlying dimension, that kind of strange zone of sentience where the spirit wanders from one to the other? How do we approach that zone when it is clear, as you say here, of course you can trace the handshakes, you can see how it happens, that's the visible side of it, but underlying it is also something that is invisible, which in this awkward manner of this Hollywood movie can only be rendered through kind of shooting some scenes in video by saying, like, okay, listen here, we see what the invisible sees, how the invisible sees. But there is an underlying logic of the invisible. Something has happened, and the absence and the invisibility of that which has happened generations and generations ago, in its invisibility, comes to inhabit the visible. But how do we get back into that zone where the invisible underlying emotional charge that powers all these moments of transfer and transference and all the knowledge that's handing down, where that comes from? A beautiful, beautiful film, also a very skeptical film, that raises this question, how to get into that invisible zone where all the desires and emotional charges come from, of course, is Tarkovsky's Stalker. There are three men, an operative community, a male bond of a writer, a scientist, and a guide, the stalker, travel into a forbidden zone in search of a particular place where all desires come true. And this place is called the zone. And a lot of the conversations in the film is like highly symbolical male banter. It's constantly about male identity and who knows what and who can do what. And the knowledge of the writer, the knowledge of the scientist, the knowledge of the performer, the guide. And at the end, however, all this symbolic knowledge economy breaks down in the face of the zone. At the end, they reach the room, but they don't dare to enter it because they're mortally afraid of having their own desires realized. You know? So the film operates in this liminal zone where the zone and all these invisible forces constantly remain tangible, and that's Tarkovsky's mastery by remaining invisible throughout the entire movie. You never see anything. And then in the end, there's this fundamental breakdown of this symbolic economy, this of the operative community of man as they reach the zone, that final room and the final threshold, which they would only have to cross to confront the true nature of their desire to see where it's all coming from. And at that moment, they collapse and they return. And I'm going to show you that scene a little bit that leads up to it. And then in the end, the very last scene of the movie, where we see someone actually acting towards the invisible, activating the invisible in a motion that normally a hand should do, and that in this film is telekinetically performed. It's really, really beautiful. So Tarkovsky approaching the zone, and then one final gesture of entering it. So what have we learned about the moment of learning? We have these learned fraternities of men who know how to perform their handshakes. And by performing these handshakes, they get jobs done, and at the same time, things pass through them. Sometimes it's purses, sometimes it's demons. But when they're then in the enactment of their capacities to be writers, scientists or warriors reach the limit of that economy where they have to face the undercurrents, that strange zone of desire, that economy breaks down and they can no longer operate. Who at the end of the film, however, operates is this child with the headscarf. She feels the vibrations, no? She's somehow in tune. She feels that which rocks the surface, the strange train that's shaking the building. So she's got her face on the surface that transfers, that transmits those vibrations. And she's not even using her hands. No, she's using her pure forces of psychic sentience to move stuff. And what we see here in this kind of strange slippage of the glass is a recurrence of what we've seen before when the purse fell, right? So the glass falls, and there is something in that moment when you tap into the zone, when you tap into that invisible zone, where that remainder appears again. Something falls, something hits the ground. And so there seems to be a moment of irreversibility in that moment when you enter the zone, right? Something drops, it's gone. And there is something about the knowledge that this image shows is that when you enter the zone, at the heart of all these operations is the question, what's the difference between this and that? No, it's full, it's empty, and you won't be able to get the water back into this cup. That's the kind of strange moment of irreversibility that enters in the moment when you approach the limit of the economy. Inside the economy, everything is reversible, everything can be exchanged, there can always be a third man entering. But when you reach the limit, something's lost, something is gone, a relic is produced, and that's irreversible. Who takes care of that irreversible rest and remainder? And what I'm now going to say, and I have to make kind of three exclamation marks, is because now I'm still talking about traditions, right? So in the same way that I've tried to describe the tradition of male bonding, and all these kind of slides and of the hand and handshakes through which male economies have traditionally been created. I now want to talk a little bit about the position that women traditionally occupy. And I'm doing that not to say that there is some kind of natural capacity of women that would destine them or predestine them to be in that position. I'm still talking about techniques. No, there are certain techniques that traditionally men get initiated to, and there are certain techniques that are being imposed on women. So I'm not trying to naturalize it. I'm just trying to say maybe to understand and reevaluate certain cultural techniques that happen on the limits of those economies of transference and knowledge transfer. We have to reevaluate other capacities, and those have traditionally been imposed or assigned to women. And I want to first of all reevaluate them, show their incredible force, but also speak about them as techniques that, of course, could be brought in and could be embodied by other bodies too. But I think it's no coincidence that the character in this movie, who Tarkovsky assigns the position of that creature who can tap into the zone, here is a veiled woman. Because traditionally, wearing the veil, and tapping into that zone of that which is transferred from generation to generation, all the pain and the joy that passes on, that is the job of the veiled woman, in a way testifying, witnessing the emotions as they pass from generation to generation, in a strange a state of touching on the visible and the invisible, separated by the veil. No, this is from El Gato Pardo. And the traditional moment where that which leaves the economy, the dead rest, that which drops, which is irreversibly dead, where that moment, where that is witnessed by people who wear the veil, is of course the moment of the pietà, no, where the dead body drops out irreversibly, like before all the handshakes, all the moves have been executed, there has been an execution, and now what's left over, like, and what testifies to the pain that has been transferred again and again, that rest is taken care of by the veiled woman. And it seems as she is taking care of it, there's almost a moment of relief. No, the man has left the economy. Finally, he's done. No, he got the job done. He's done. Oh, we're ready. No, that is the moment of confession, where you have confessed all, and you still do that in the moment of representation. No, the man for man, when you reach the limit, you become a maturer, and then you confess, you testify, and it's still visually effective. No, you close your eyes. Everybody can see. You're relieved, no? But, no, that's the moment of the, you produce a grand display, but that's where you hit the limit. You embody the pain, you represent it, but after you're done with that job, it's someone else's job to take what's left over. No, after the economy of representation reaches its limits and the rest, that pain, is thrown out, someone else has to take care of it. And that's usually, as you see in Botticelli's painting, it's messy business, no? And it's no longer kind of organized representations of singularity and individuality. It's collectivity. No, this is the collective zone of pain. And as the remainder is picked up in that zone, it's a big mess, no? And of half-veiled and half-visible bodies taking up the mess. No? It's a tough job, as you can see here. No? The question is, how can we activate that practice, that practice of receiving that bit, that remainder that drops out from the symbolical economy of transfer and transference, that little piece of shit that drops out at the end of the day? How can we receive it and turn that into an agency? Because classically, of course, the Holy Mother is condemned to passivity. No, she can just take the shit and hold it there. And because he's had the main attention, he got all the show, he got all the attraction on the cross, and now she has just to carry that little bit that's left over. And how could that be twisted into a practice that is neither really a practice of representation and is not a practice of transference that is a continuation of all those handshakes, but a practice that is based on that little rest that is left over and operates with it. And a work by an artist who I admire enormously is this piece by Susan Hiller called 13 Male Absences. And it's an installation that is organized, the one piece in the installation that kind of contextualizes the rest is are these two photos of these two women archaeologists picking up the pieces. No, they're really picking up the pieces, they're picking up what's left over, and they're organizing it. Of course, you could say, is that not the job that women have always done? No, like if you look at traditional art scenes, no, of course you've got the man who are, performing, doing their handshakes, cheating as hell, and then, of course, there'll always be a woman who picks them up and who writes art history. You know, like, there's always the mediators, the art historians are very often, when you look at modernist art scenes, they're women, no? Picking up the pieces. Are they not just writing the history, producing the representation, setting the stage for all those guys? And I think it is part of the fundamental and beautiful irony of this piece that it includes a disavowal of the continuation of that job, because it's called 13 Male Absences, and what's collected here are these little pieces of shit, and they do not form a coherent representation. No, as you see here, they're really male absences. There is nothing. There is nothing much left. There's just lots of stained paper. Now, there are lots of stains and traces that remain on the limit of the visible. They do not become a narration again. This archaeologist, she's refusing to put the pieces together in a coherent order that would reproduce a representation of male glory. No, but at the same time, she's in a way seizing and appropriating that cultural position that women have been traditionally assigned of having to be the one who pick up the pieces. She's picking up the pieces, but turning it into a completely different activity and mocking the order of representation, the order of visibility as she's doing so. Another artist who I find equally thrilling for understanding, like, or dealing and acting, bringing all this messiness of that moment of being left with the mess into the work and turning it into a principle of activity is Alina Szapocznikov, a Polish artist who did her main body of work in the 1960s and 70s, where you can see how one principle, the principle of that messiness, that de-individualized messiness, where subjectivity becomes collectivity as you enter this kind of zone of pain. She takes that principle of the zone of pain, that messiness, and turns it into proactively turns it into a sculptural principle. This relief piece is called Alina's Funeral, and what you have here in this kind of messy blob piece of vomit and gum is lots of faces. And on the bottom of the panel, you see a self-portrait, a photo of the artist wrapped in a concentration camp uniform. Szapocznikov survived 3 concentration camps. And it seems that there is a moment of testifying to this pain that keeps wandering from body to body in this piece. No, it is exactly that moment of transference, death that refuses to die, like the death that keeps coming back, that haunts you. And it is precisely in this messiness, what probably Maurice Merleau-Ponty would call the flesh of the world, where the pain is interconnected. It cannot be divided symbolically in an economy. It is one big mess. And as such, it is presented, but it is proactively presented. It's not a way of just taking in the shit, but it's a way of spitting it out again and doing so in the form of a sculpture. So it is precisely that rest, that remainder, that piece of shit that talks back. Now here we have the shit talking back. The anus opens up and becomes a mouth and starts talking and showers you with kisses. It's another piece by Alina Shapotsnikov. And I want to argue that maybe when we tap into that zone of pain, that zone of sentience, Freudian slippage, of course, when we think about it predominantly and only in terms of trauma, as that which underlies all these symbolical orders, the demon that keeps singing time is on my side, it is the pain that needs to be thrown out, that needs to be avowed on the limits of visibility. But maybe there is also a joy to be had and to be found as we tap into the zone, a strange kind of jouissance, a jouissance that these guys are as much afraid of as of taking on the pain. No? It is the terrible burden of facing that question, tell me what you want, what you really, really want. And in the face of that question, these guys collapse as much as they collapse in the face of the responsibility to take on the burden. So what about enacting collective enjoyment in a different kind of logic? This is a video piece by the artist J. Tan, where she got a group of women together to enact a strange kind of ballet of organizing objects in a swimming pool. So it's shot above water and underwater. And I'm trying to argue that as we tap into the zone of sentience and activate that strange collective competence that goes beyond the symbolic order of handshakes, but is more a form of co-inhabitation of a zone of feeling. What we have here is a principle of knowledge, a not necessarily symbolic knowledge that has traditionally been assigned to the woman's role in society. And when we talk about artistic knowledge today, I think we should be well advised to not only look at the symbolic processes and all these many handshakes that make people sing the same song, and not acknowledging the emotional burden and emotional energies that keeps empowering that system of transference, but to face those emotional energies and look precisely at those fields of culture in which tapping into that zone of the emotional and psychological undercurrents has traditionally been enacted and embodied, and look precisely at the tradition of feminist artists and see what kind of other strategies of tapping into knowledge and embodying knowledge and sharing knowledge have been developed in that line of tradition.